everyone. Thank you so much for joining me and my guest today. This is Hashtag No Limits, and Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into cells and then reforms into the butterfly. And then, as if all of that wasn't challenging and difficult enough, it has to struggle for its wings to be strong enough to fly once it gets out of the cocoon. If we as humans help it, we're actually not helping it. We're actually doing it harm if we try to take it out of the cocoon before it's ready. And so while all of that is very difficult, so is busting through limits that society places on a person. And today, I'm very happy to bring to you Hassan Davis. I met Hassan back in November at a Juvenile Justice Council conference, and his story just touched my heart so much that I wanted to bring him to all of you. Hassan, thank you for joining us today. Happy New Year and welcome.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's been a few months since I've seen you. So what kind of fun things have you done in that amount of time?
Well, I got off the road after COVID kind of shut everything down.
Yeah. And,
but last year, I guess last year, not last year.
Yeah, we're in 2023 now.
Things began to open up about March, and then it just, you know, became this kind of whirlwind. That finally finished up early December for me. I was so excited to be back on the road, but to take that break, my family and I took a big vacation, took a big break over the holidays. A lot of us got together and did a cruise and traveled, just disconnected from the world and connected to each other. And that was very nice. My boys are both home from school and around the world in their own stuff. And so it was very nice. And now I'm ready to get back to hope dealing.
Yes, absolutely. So I didn't say that. This is Hassan Dealer, the Hope Dealer. Hassan Davis, the Hope Dealer. I said your name wrong there. And so tell us, I mean, just your story is just absolutely incredible. So I'm just going to let you tell your story. If you want to do it similarly to, you know, how you told it at the Juvenile Council, that's great. If you want to, it's all you. This is all you, buddy.
Well, you know, I guess a place to start is always at the beginning. And I'll start with a few pieces and we can see where we want to go from there. So as a young person, I experienced a lot of challenges, internally and externally. Internally, deaf in one ear, severe visual impairment that continues to, macular degeneration that's continuing to be a challenge, ADHD and dyslexia. And so those as a combination as a very young child really created lots of challenges. My parents divorced, in an ugly situation when I was really young. And we began to do what lots of young people do whose main family structure, kind of falls apart, moving from place to place and trying to get settled. My mother worked very hard and did an incredible job of keeping me and my siblings together and with her and every once in a while having to meet us out to other family members and support systems until she could get herself stable again. What I remember about that is the intentional piece of having a community that we can lean into that prevented the system from being the thing that decided, what a single mother struggling to keep her family together had to do or had to experience. In first grade, I think it was really clear. I always say, I entered the school to prison pipeline officially in the first grade. Being that kid who couldn't sit still and couldn't stop touching things that weren't his, the kid who's standing on tables trying to reach things other people couldn't even see or imagine, the kid who couldn't take lines and make letters, letters and make words, words and make sense, that in all of the ways that mattered in that moment, that broken kid that so many times we see in our classrooms. My first grade teacher who I have very little memory of now. Someone asked me once, do you ever go back and look for us? No, I I have no desire to go back to that. But in that moment, the first weeks of my first grade school year, she made a decision. And she grabbed me up by the arm and drug me out of my seat and across the room in front of my classmates to the back of the room, to the closet, the coat room where we keep all the stuff that nobody uses. Right. And when we got there, she explained to me that this was going to be my new classroom. This was going to be the place where I got to be. As she turned around to go and teach the brilliant, beautiful children, I guess. And on the way out, she locked the door behind her. And that became my ritual. Every morning she would drag me across the room and into the box and explain that this is your space and go off to do whatever you do with children that are going to be something.
Yeah, I'm gonna pause right here. I'm just because for those who are just listening and are not seeing, you and I are about the same age. We're right around the 50 year mark. And mm-hmm. when you were in first grade, the law about special education, because it's the same for me, was brand new.
Brand new. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And yeah. So I didn't want anyone who might just be listening and who didn't see the both of us and see how what our ages are, we're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this maybe just happened 10 years ago or something. So yes, this was in like in the 1970s.
70s. And that's a great 80s. Point. One of the things as a professional now looking back, I realize that literally it was like the year before that, maybe even that year, right, that all of this legislation had been passed. And so In some way, it doesn't make sense. It, you know, the value of it and the treatment doesn't make sense. But people ask all the time, why didn't anything happen to that teacher? Well, because we didn't know anything about this. We were trying to still figure right. this out in so many ways. But so she would lock me in that box every day and explain that this was the place that I was going to be. And I would scream at the walls and punch the coats. But I would go home and I didn't tell my mom. You know, she was trying to make sure her babies was in the same place next month and had three meals. And she had real things to worry about. Not worrying about, you know, this kid who, you know, clearly the world was telling me something about myself. And this is all my self-talk and internal pieces. But my mother always had this amazing sense of power and purpose. She would tell us things like, you know, everybody faces difficult things, but things you have to figure out how you got into that difficult place and then how you use it. What can you do with it? Because there's a lesson in everything. And I didn't know, but after days and days of being locked in this box, one day I dried my eyes and stopped punching the coats. And I looked up and I don't know why it took me so long, but I realized that that coat room was where all the other kids kept their lunch boxes. And God's plan was revealed, like, the heavens. Susie always had the peanut butter jelly sandwiches without the crust. Bobby always had fruit cups, which is a new thing. And then Jimmy had Tang instant breakfast drink. And so all the most amazing food in the world showed up every day. And so after a while, I was like, is it time to go to the coat room yet, teacher? I'm ready to go, you know? So at some point, Mama started coming to school complaining about their babies coming home hungry. And they came to investigate the mystery of the coat room. Like a Scooby-Doo episode. And there I was, eight lunch boxes spread around me like a buffet. And I guess that teacher was so frustrated, maybe embarrassed and scared that she was going to get in some trouble. She drug me out of that box and across the room to that one special seat right next to the teacher. We all know that one seat next to the teacher. Right. And so she can keep an eye on that bad boy who was other children's food. And that was how I got out of the box and at least in the zone, because what they didn't know then, well, we didn't have all this science around differently able and learning styles, is that I'm one of those oral engaged learners that literally, if you put me in a room where young people are engaged at a high level and I can roll with them and I can climb with them at a steady pace. But without that interaction, which is the number one way that I learn, without some kind of reaction and some kind of engagement, then I just die. And so being back in the space was enough to at least keep me going and give me an avenue out. And so that became my journey through childhood, was always through a lens of being removed from class, being isolated, having teachers call me out when it was time to do reading, open reading. You know, we would go around the room knowing that this was the piece, and they would, you know, instead of being gracious and giving me a space, you know, oh, we'll just give it a try. The kids started learning really quickly. Don't sit really close to that guy, because when the teacher calls him, he's going to find somebody, you know, because I'd rather be that crazy kid who attacks mm-hmm. people for no reason than that really stupid boy who can't read a paragraph. And so school became a really tenuous place for me. I navigated 5 different elementary schools over a short period of time, 13 different home environments, as my mother continued to move to try and find us that place of stability. And then at 11 years old, on top of all that, I had my first real deep run-in with law enforcement. I got arrested with my buddies, and long story short, wound up on probation for the rest of my childhood. Wow. And there's a lot that goes into that. When we look at statistics and the data that is really clear, not just in the last 20 years, but the last 40 years or so, how young people with disabilities and experiencing the world with challenges are often more likely to be targeted in educational settings, isolated, restrained, removed, secluded, suspended, expelled. And if those same young people become more likely then to experience the other things that come from that, you know, higher chances of involvement in law enforcement. If you happen to be a youth of color, if you happen to be a youth experiencing poverty, then those are multipliers. And so as a Black male with learning challenges in poverty, navigating systems, there were some folk who were basically saying, you know, go ahead and just wipe this one off the board. There is no way this gets better. But for a mother who, again, you know, with amazing advice, but amazing actions. When I got arrested, I was at the police station with my buddies, and there was this long, drawn out drama that really captures what that day was, including having one of the police officers who happened to be a cousin of the manager of the apartments we lived in. And, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and the surrounding area, East Point College Park, which at some point was identified as one of the most openly racist, you know, Ku Klux Klan. I mean, it had all of that stuff. And so even in our apartment complex, these apartments, you know, we have a clubhouse, and it did things that you imagine clubhouses do, have parties. But the job of this police officer when he was off duty would be to sit outside the clubhouse and explain to those of us who were not white that we weren't actually invited to this party, even though it was a party for all of the residents of the community. And so, we had moved from there, but he comes in. His name was Gil. And I hope that he's still living his life, but he came into the police station while we were being processed and looked at the 5 of us and just said, all right, wow, I didn't know that call was about you all when it came in. If it was, I would have took it. And then he just kind of grinned. He says, and I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have all made it here today. And he just,
oh my gosh.
And so that was the tension of the day. And then all my buddies were all between the ages of 11 and 13. And this is kind of the environment. So all the mamas start showing up, and they all come in like mamas in crisis do. Sideways, you know, sometimes angry. And, you know, one of the things I realized, again, in this work is parents, especially mamas, but parents of young people who are navigating these systems have only a few responses when the system is throwing so much at them. You see it when we talk about education access, when we're talking about the courts, we're talking about child welfare across the board. You know, if they can show up angry or ugly. Right. And, yeah. I mean, that's kind of it. And when they do, the system does such a great job of saying, well, you know, if you're going to talk like that or act like that, then we're not going to deal with you. Even though, you know, we know that anger, you know, covers up fear and embarrassment and concern about losing your babies and losing the things that you're really trying to do, even though life is hard. These mamas and daddies are working hard to make something happen out of nothing very often. And so again, as a professional now, when I have you know, I'm the former commissioner of juvenile justice for the state of Kentucky. I ran the entire juvenile justice system here. I'm vice chair of the Federal Advisory Committee on Juvenile Justice. I advise and coach leaders across the country. And when I talk to them, I say it's so critical for us to understand now that all of us are in the service work to people who are in crisis. It is the nature that they don't even get to us unless there's a crisis. And we have all actually been trained to deal with crisis. So how is it that the only people in a room who have been trained to navigate crisis are the ones that have the right and the ability to say, well, I ain't going to talk to you because you called me out of my name, to get indignant and upset because people in crisis show up at our doors? And so for me, I started pushing my team and said, look, you can't, I mean, I know it hurts your feelings, but take a deep breath and get over that, because after that, you are the only person in the world who might be able to actually come to something better at the end of this conversation than where we started. And so I ask those professionals, you know, not to take this personal, whether you're a probation officer or a school counselor or, you know, a court worker or a social worker. All of us have this skill set, but our feelings get in the way of the thing we came to do.
Right.
That being said, all these mamas came in just that way. And my mother hadn't showed up yet. So I was like, maybe I should just ask the police to keep me. That seems like a better alternative than going home tonight. And but she finally got there, and she came in really slow, and she was calm as I was like, this is not good, right? Because I'm being all excited, they're trying to get their head around the fact there's a problem. When they come in calm, they've already got a solution, and I was so afraid what that solution would be. She did the paperwork, thanked the police officer. I was like, this is not good. And I was like, okay, all right. Maybe you don't go off in a police station like that because there's a chance somebody might arrest you, right? I mean, this and yeah. But I don't know, when we get outside, I don't know what I'm going to do. So we got outside. I always tell people, I did the near, far, near walk. That's when you walk close enough to somebody that everybody knows that you're with them. You're close in proximity, but you're not actually close enough to them. They can reach you if they start to swing all of a sudden, right? So it's right. Near, far, near walking. And I'm watching. In case she jumps, and she's just calm. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you don't go off in the police station because they might arrest you. You don't go off in the police station parking lot. They might call social services, open up a case, come to the house, investigate. I don't know what I'm going to do when we get in the car. See, she had to borrow a car from one of our neighbors to come get us. We didn't have one at the time. And I got in the car, no seatbelt on, hand on the doorknob, doing the thing. Like, I may have to bail out, right? And I was just waiting. All of these things playing in my mind like they would if you're in this situation, trying to figure out what the rational response is to this really irrational thing we're in. And so we're driving, and it's late. It's a Sunday, and we've been out all day, and so it's late. And we're driving past the streetlights, and somewhere along on the road, I finally got the courage to look up at her. And she was just crying these huge silent tears. And she looked down at me and she said, baby, if you could just see what I see every time that I look at you, then you know how great you already were. And all I could do is feel really stupid in that moment. I was like, you know, how do you, you know, that's not something you can react to and, you know, oh, you don't understand. I got to survive, you know.
Right.
I just sat there trying to figure out what is it with this laundry list that's building behind my name of who this is to the whole world. How could she still look me in the face and say those words without blinking, without laughing? And so it made me curious. If she see something, and maybe I was the one that hasn't been looking hard enough. Now I call it the double vision. It's like the core of what I think when I think of hope dealers, the ability to see clearly the truth of the present and acknowledge this is where we are. And at the same time, still see and imagine with and for them something much more amazing and powerful because you are there with them. Yeah. And that settled me. I mean, I was again, the judge put me on probation for the rest of my childhood, making sure that any natural action that a teen or preteen would with the frontal lobe that's not developed would do in the world would trigger a response that would take me out of the world for however long. And so I began to spend lots of time with my mom and my stepfather, who would come into the picture. And, you know, they got me involved in arts. They got me involved in creative outlets. You know, and one of the things that we know is young people who have access to creative engagement, the ability to expand and explore who they are in the world, are much more likely to see and value other people in the world. We know that, you know, social emotional engagement tools of self-management, the ability to see and value other people, to be part of a team, all those things that we want young people to have, not soft skills, but essential skills necessary right. to navigate in a community, all come from creative engagement, which, by the way, are the very first things that are taken away from young people in poverty, young people experiencing challenges in school, young people of color in poor communities very often. And so all the things that we know stabilize young people and give them a breadth of experiences to think about who they could be in the world are the things that we lose. And my mother, you know, we went off on and off the food stamp rolls and on and off of welfare, and we struggled in public housing in one way or another for a long time. You know, getting to wake up in the middle of the night saying, get up, don't turn the lights, get your stuff, we got to go. You'll be in a new school tomorrow. But at the same time, my mother would go out of the way to take us to the High Museum of Art to make sure that we went to the symphony whenever the school took all the kids to the Skiff Symphony. It only cost $1.50, but she made sure, even if it was, you know, she put those pennies and nickels together. She would put us on the bus and take us downtown to live theater. And there would be people who criticize, you know, if you're barely making it, you know, you shouldn't be spending money on that. And my mother was adamant. She's an artist and she believes in the arts. And she says, what my children need is to know that the whole world is theirs. Mm-hmm. And there's so many limits that we put on people who don't have, and we don't create opportunity for them to engage in a way that lets them see this can be you too. This is yours too, and you can enjoy and value these, and you can aspire to these things, right? And maybe there's not a surprise when you hear that I'm an actor touring 3 one-man shows around the country for the last 25 years, that I tell these stories because I know how powerful stories are to bringing community together and building and repairing some of those broken parts of our past, right? And so. I don't even know. I get all excited and get, you know, caught up in the story. So childhood was interesting. I was on probation. The next year, things were really leveling out for my family. And just as my mother and stepfather were getting stabilized in their own work, and you know, we moved from a one-bedroom apartment, the five of us, to a two-bedroom apartment. And my stepbrother Sean moved in with us. And so, you know, we had more space and things like that. Things were really working. And just a few days after Christmas, one of the units caught on fire. One of the mothers was making dinner for her husband who works the third shift, and the baby started crying. And in a few minutes she was going to check on the baby. That bacon grease caught fire in the pan. And that bacon grease fire from the pan went to the cabinet, from the cabinet to the walls, from the walls to the ceiling, and it hit that insulation. And because, you know, in the 70s, the idea of firewalls between each of the units in housing for the public just seemed like nonsense. You know, why waste the government's good money on poor people who, you know? And so when it hit that insulation, the entire building of 10 families lost everything. And so by the end of the night, we were homeless again. The next morning, I was walking to school in somebody else's shoes again. And being thankful when somebody says, oh, that was the sweater my grandmama gave me. And, you know, swallowing that pain that comes from living in other people's right. grace to still be thankful. And because mom didn't want me in my 6th elementary school, she kept me there, even though the whole family had to relocate back into downtown Atlanta. And I started a ritual of, you know, 5 o'clock, wake up, catch a bus in the downtown, take a second bus back out, and then walk to school to finish my 7th grade school year. And at the end of that school year, in the eighth grade, I was enrolled in alternative school. And I always say that I call it alternative school, but it was actually an amazing school on a number of levels. One, I was there for the next 5 years. In year two, I realized that it was actually a private school. In year three, I realized that my mother had been working with the administrator for the last 2 years to work at the school doing odd projects and things to keep me in the school. And around that time, the family was still struggling. So my mother had to send all the kids out again in order to really get stable. So she sent my older sister back to my father in St. Louis. My younger sister went to stay with relatives. My brother went to stay with my aunt in Milwaukee. And I moved into the school as its first residential student. And and so, you know, again, we had a community that could hold us and help us navigate without the system being the thing that tears the family apart. And so many families, they need a respite. They need a way to kind of get their energy back. And this was ours. And so I'm moving into the school. So the most amazing thing about this school was called Horizon School. And it opened just a year before I started school there. And they actually closed their doors. Been 2 years now. Very sad. But the administrator at Horizon School, Dr. Lorraine Wilson, was the most amazing educational leader I've ever met. When I met Dr. Wilson, Lorraine, we called her. She had these really thick glasses that magnified her eyes, and she was legally blind, and so the world turned to shadow about 2 feet in front of her. And so she always walked with this purpose and this calm because she had to know and sense the world around her. I still, to this day, even though she's passed years ago, think that she was a Jedi. and that the Force is still present because sometimes just feel that energy. But I was called, in this school, which allowed the students to be, have a voice in what happened. And if there were problems, we would all get together and troubleshoot. And the first time I got in trouble, my first year, there were several of us who got in trouble and waiting for, you know, expecting that thing you, when you're the kid who gets in trouble, you know, we're just going to put you out of here. She called us all together. And she said, your punishment for breaking the rules and doing all this stuff that you did is that you are now the student body leadership. And you have to come up with rules and expectations for students. And we were like, what? That's crazy. Are you serious? And she was absolutely serious. And when I look back on it, we probably had the most draconian rules because, you know, letting kids like, you know, Lord of the Flies. But it was brilliant because it immediately co-opted all of those dissonant voices into a sense of leadership and ownership. And this was our space. And for me, this was absolutely my home for the 5 years that I was there. But I gotten in trouble and sent her office once or called her office. And I went in and sat down and she wasn't there. And I waited for her to come in and she, you know, I can hear her navigating down the hall and slowly making her way to our office. Everything is always in the same place. And she sits in the seat right across from me. And she just kind of sits there for an uncomfortable amount of time for people with ADHD and things are always happening. And so, you know, I've had 50 scenarios operating in my brain before she starts to speak. And she says, I know who you are. And I was like, oh, that's not a good start. But then she says, and I think that you can accomplish anything you set your mind to. So I just for a second, because that clearly did not jive with the reason I came to her office. And then I was like, well, she's blind. And so I did the eyeball check, you know, you kind of swear, and she just looked straight ahead. And so finally I cleared my throat and said, Lorraine, you know, it's Hassan, right? And she sat there for a few minutes. I mean, it seemed like ever. And she said, I know who you are. And I think that you can accomplish anything that you set your mind to. And all that you could do, Hassan, is make me a fool for believing such things about you.
Wow.
And for the first time in my educational career, someone told me I was already great, dared me to sacrifice being great for something else.
Yeah. And
I think about that double vision, right? Clearly you are here in all of this chaos. And at the same time, I see you and I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to be with you. And so I call her my HD2, hope dealer number two. And she and my mother, I learned years later, they conspired. They planned and they plotted in amazing ways to make me see myself like they imagined me. Dr. Wilson would do things like in class, I would be bouncing around and messing with things that weren't mine because I had no connection to what was going on with the rest of the students who knew what was going on. And she would do things like, Hassan, do you think you want to go outside and run around the school as hard as you can? And I was like, what? Yes. I mean, until you said it, I had never thought about it. But as soon as you said it, that's exactly what I think I want to do. And she would say, then go ahead and do it. And everybody else would be like, what? And I would go outside and I would run around the school four, five times until I can barely walk. I'm passing out from oxygen deprivation. When I came back into the room, this amazing thing would happen. There are these commercials like for Claritin or nasal, Benadryl, all these about being congested. And the first I saw one about 5 or 6 years ago where like it starts with this really blurry picture. Yep. It's like your TV is blurred. You can't quite see. Everybody's talking. It's all like this. And then they take the medicine and then they pull the edge back like a film. And there's this beautiful, crisp spring picture. Have you ever seen?
Yes, absolutely. I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I'm sitting with my wife and that happened. I said, that's it. And I screamed. And she's like, well, what are you talking about? Said, that's it. That's what happens when I can burn off enough energy to slow my brain down. The whole world gets sharp edges. And Dr. Rain Wilson taught me that. I learned that if I could exert enough energy, I could control the bouncing and the touching and I could sit in class for about 30 minutes and make connections and things made sense. And I would input things at the right time. And I was like, oh, so she was subtly teaching me that I didn't have to, I could regulate this. It took a lot, but physical exertion, physical activity became a huge part of my life in the rest of high school through college and all that because I started learning. I can actually do something about this. I don't just have to sit here going, gosh, I just wish I could understand and focus like everyone else. And so she gave me gifts like that. And I know in class, in math class, I would particularly get upset because she told me one day that I was what she said that I was a natural mathematician, right? That I was just, that I could look at the math problem and I could give the math answer. And most of the times I did it, I was right. But then every time I got my papers back, I would fail the papers. And I would complain to her. So, well, you said that the answer's right. And then one day she said, well, Hassan, and every math teacher, every time I say this with educators, I'm like, math isn't about the answer. It's about, and they all in unison, the process. Yeah. That's what she said to me. I said, well, how come on this paper you gave me, there's no place to ask that has process, right? It says problem. It says answer. It doesn't say problem. And I argue with her all the time because I was She said, that does not make it any better, Hassan. The answer is not the thing we work on. It's the process. And so I would get so frustrated having the answer and not knowing how I got to the answer and not being able to share that. And so still not doing well. And then one day a week, she started doing this thing. She would just stop and she would say, okay, clear your desk. And once everybody cleared the desk, she would just start. 13 times 3 plus 1 divided by 5 times 10, whatever it was, whatever series of numbers and symbols she threw out there, as soon as she stopped, 40, I always had the answer.
Wow.
And so one day a week, she made me math god of the universe. She gave me the ability to step away from what I'd been doing since elementary school, looking for somebody to attack when I look stupid, I could take a deep breath and go, okay, I know when my time is. On Wednesday, I got everybody. And so I could sit patiently and not be frustrated, knowing that there was a space for me to shine, that I had gifts to give that other people couldn't touch. And so it gave me a sense that I had value, even though it was different. Right? And so she was amazing in really setting that for me. And over the course of the 3 years that I lived there with her at the school, she always was navigating with me. Unfortunately, my senior year, December, I just turned 18. We were just about to go on winter break, and she called me back to that office, sat me in that very same seat, and explained that I just failed the class. Like I said, you know, life didn't become a miracle. It was just I was managing, like so many young people do. And she said, unfortunately, Hassan, you failed the class that you need for graduation, and that class won't be offered again before the end of the year, which means that you won't be eligible to graduate. Which means I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And,
oh my.
Yeah. And that broke so much of me, because most of the success that I'd experienced in the last few years had been through this small community that it really made me feel like, you know, I had something, I was part of something, even though, you know, it wasn't, So you know, we finished, and I had to pack up my room at the school, and one of my classmates gave me a ride back home, and my mother had the family back together, and everybody was back in one home again, and my brothers, my best friends Derek and Sean, my foster brother Derek and my stepbrother Sean, who were the two. I have a younger brother Tony, but Sean and Derek were the two that I spent most of my time with, and brilliant, amazing guys. And so it was great to be back with them. In fact, they were so brilliant, all three of my brothers, that my biggest hope was that the world would get to know them, that, you know, if there was something I could do, even if it took sacrificing myself as the oldest, to really get them to a place where the world could see how amazing they were, I thought that would be totally worth it. Because the laundry list that was building behind my name was so, ADHD, dyslexia, visual hearing impairment after 5 different elementary schools, a juvenile arrest, on probation since childhood, expelled from alternative school, and I was plotting to get the GED. I mean, nothing about that, when you lay it out on a graph chart, screams, we're on the way to something amazing. But I thought that if I could make enough room for the world to see my brothers, it would be worth it. Mm-hmm. But as I moved forward, the further out I got to clear room for them, the more I saw them not being able to believe that they had a right, that they could be more. This one of the stories I'll tell, and I'll take a deep breath, and maybe if you have questions, but I came home from school to visit once, and my brother Sean was chilling in the corner talking real low. This is the 80s, you know, he was kind of, and I was like, yo, Kaz, what are you doing? We called him Casanova Kaz. That was his tag. And he was like, yo, man, I'm talking to my girl. I mean, if your name is Casanova, you got to talk like that,
sure,
right?
Sure, right, exactly.
Are you talking to a girl with wires tied around your head? So I took the wires from him. I was like, hello? Hello, somebody answered. I was like, oh, snap, dude. Where did you get this? Like, you remember that old Walkman? I was like, yeah, you know, old Walkmans, right? You know, 20 batteries, you got your music for half a day. And he said, well, I took that old Walkman, and I took mama's broken telephone, and I took them apart. And I started messing with the wires inside until I got some static. So I kept messing with it until I got a dial tone. And I called my girl. I was like, wait a minute, you made this. He was like, yeah. I said, no. You made this. He said, yeah. I said, no. You made, I wasn't sure if you understood the question. You made this. He said, yes, I made it. Now, get that. My baby brother built a telephone headset in his bedroom so he could chill in the corner and talk to his girl. This was 1980. Wow. We didn't have telephone headsets. We had an old phone in the kitchen. The operator for assistance. And I said, Sean, you could be one of those electric guys. That's all I have, but it seemed pretty exciting. And he just started laughing. He said, no, man, it's just what I do when we're hanging out at the house. But nobody's going to let me do this in the real world. And then he got really quiet. I said, bruh, we don't get to be great in the real world. And that was that was the moment that I understood that as brilliant as he, that all of them were, that they'd been told so many times that this wasn't the life they could have access to, that they finally just accepted it.
Wow.
And what's interesting is even years later, my brother mentioned that again, because, you know, Sean and Derek are both serving life sentences now, and they're still two of the most brilliant people I've met. I've shook hands with President. I've testified before Congress. I lectured in a castle in Sweden, in Switzerland, above literally a castle above a lake, you know, to international leaders. And still, these are two of the most brilliant people I've ever met. But there's so many young folk who navigate in the world that get that message that this ain't for you so often that they finally just say, okay, it must be true or everybody wouldn't be saying it. And, you know, the thing that, you know, having those voices is a big piece of it, but then you have to believe and continue to push hard against it. Because years later, I went to visit my brother and he was joking about something that happened between us. And then he got really serious. He says, you know what I wish, man? He says, I wish that I could have believed Mama when she told me I was great.
Hmm.
And it hit me. Because at first I was like, wait a minute. I thought I was the only one she told that. Right? So you think that you're special.
Right, right.
But then it struck me, especially when I put it in the framework of what it means to be a hope dealer. Right? We don't know when or how or who is going to touch. But if all of us are investing like that, then it might be something. So good hope dealers are telling everybody, not because it's a fancy word, but because they believe it and they're willing to do what it takes to help you get there, but you got to believe it too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this quote that I use often that I have, hope is a seed planted in rocky soil with no knowledge of how deep its roots will sink or how many its fruit will feed, but we still choose to plant and to wait and to see. It's all about the potential. That's the great thing about hope. It's a future lying statement. It's not about right now. It's what about what I do right now, how it could, in the perfect circumstances, with the right light and the right energy and the right courageous heart, it could bloom into something amazing. And too often there are folks who get into this work at some point who feel like they're not doing anything good because they haven't seen anything amazing, not knowing that every time they show up is the amazing part. Everything else is just process, right? Because it's not about the answer. It's about the process. Right. And that's what Lorraine's been trying to teach me all this time. And that's the most important part of what it means to commit yourself completely to being a hope dealer, to possibility, not guarantees. Now I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm getting myself all worked up here. Sorry about that.
And I'm going to try to compose myself enough to have some responses to all that amazing stuff that you shared. And some of this, I remember you talking about the day that I met you. And some of it, I don't know if you didn't talk about or it just didn't resonate with me then. But there, you know, one of the reasons that I do this and one of the reasons that it's called hashtag no limits is for the exactness of what you're talking about with you and your brothers, that we should not limit somebody's potential because of our own biases or beliefs or even some of our experiences. Yeah. I mean, you know, we all have bad days. Some of us have bad years. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a beautiful seed, just like you just talked about, planted that with the right nourishment, with the right opportunities, isn't going to grow and to be this most beautiful flower. And I so appreciate your story because you're successful in spite of your circumstances, in spite of the fact that the school, until you reached about eighth grade, didn't really provide you with what you needed.
Yeah.
And having been a special education teacher and been in special education in general for so long, I felt like I saw that happening too often, yeah. where, you know, the types of scenarios that you're discussing right now repeated themselves. And this is 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, I'm not talking about when the law first came out in the first 10 or 15 years of it.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about the last 15 years of it being out there and how much we should know by now, mm-hmm. but yet we're still making a lot of the same errors in judgment and a lot of the same heart issues. You know, I think there's still a lot of misconception about people's abilities.
Yes.
And, you know, whether that is their ability to, you know, have the kind of life that you have and be the kind of person that you are today. Whether that is that somebody is born with or an accident occurs and they now have some sort of a physical or a mental disability.
Right.
Whether that is that, you know, they're born into an impoverished country. I mean, there's so many stories out there,
right,
like yours. And I wrote a book with 9 of them in it. But I thought there are millions, literally millions more.
Yeah.
And I want to try to showcase those stories because they're inspiring to me and they are filled with hope. And, you know, I'm so grateful that there are people like yourself who are willing to share and that people all around the country and all around the world recognize the fact that you have a beautiful story to tell and that they let you share your story and they want you to share your story to give that hope to others as well. So what are you doing? We've got about 15 minutes. So what is a hope dealer? I'm going to pull up your website. And if there's anything on there specifically that you want me to show, let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to also put the link on how to get. Look at you all suave in your suit there.
It's back in my commissioner days when I wore a suit every day.
All right.
I don't do many suits nowadays. But I try. I mean, I don't want to look like a bum, but
Yeah. So you talked about that you were the head of all the juvenile justice departments in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So what is HassanDavis.com, which is the website? So it's HassanDavis.com. Mm-hmm. So what do you do now? What is this butterfly that you have become?
Yes. Hassan Davis Solutions is kind of this. The great thing about experiencing the world with things like dyslexia and ADHD is I've got this expansive sense, right? I try to explain to people sometimes, right? It's like I can hold multiple tracks of thinking at the same time and I can expound on them like immediately. And so it's really this sense that there's all these things going on in my head. And so when I try to pull all the things that are going in my head in one place, you get something like HassanDavis.com, Hassan Davis Solutions. The great thing I always say is even when I get distracted, it's to something else that's amazing and I love. I mentioned that I'm an actor. I have 3 one-man shows that I've toured nationally for the last 25 years. I tell the story of African-Americans in American history, people like York of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Most people, even today, 220 years later, still don't realize that there was a Black member of the Lewis and Clark Expedition from day one to day done. And so I tell his story and the story of Angus Burley, a Civil War soldier, and Joe Lewis, the boxer. During the bicentennial of Lewis and Clark Expedition, I was actually picked up by the National Parks and the Department of Interior to be York for the nation. So I was York for the bicentennial, telling his story across the country. It was amazing. I've written.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that my husband's aunt and you probably crossed paths.
That's right. Yeah.
I forgot to ask her about that.
Yeah. So we'll have to follow up on that because I'm really interested. Yeah. So, you know, spent, you know, lots of time on the trail. And even now I still, you know, I go out to schools, to universities, national parks. I'm working with the national parks right now on a project to hopefully get, York story more involved, but also do some training around how other stories can be told in these public settings to show the nation that these really are America's parks, not just some American's park. And I think there's some rich stories in all of our historical moments that really reflect that. I've written four books, written off in The Journey of Yorker right there. York is a children's book based on the York story that I tour. Written off is my story, my memoir, of navigating delinquency, poverty, and, what is it? I can't even remember what the tagline is. Delinquency, poverty, disability, and delinquency is transforming the juvenile
justice system. Yeah.
And then just in the last 6 months, I've published two more books. One is a book of poetry called Human Rights, W-R-I-T-E-S. And it's really a collection of my poetry from my early and late childhood, navigating systems and navigating those difficult places in the world to tell the story of what it's like to be in that and from different perspectives. And then my newest book is actually The Race, and it is the story of a young man who escapes special ed class. It's not even up yet. I mean, it's only been out a couple months. I've got a copy, but it's actually the story. I read it at the conference.
But, yeah, I thought so.
But the illustration of it, I've been excited about it. This is my early copy, actually, my author copy. And so it's in black and white. But it's the great story. Well, you can't even see it, of a kid who escaped special ed class, basically, to go out and see what's going on outside in the world where there's so much excitement. And then the teachers and aides tracking him down and saying, oh, no, that's not your life. Come back over here. This is what you get to do. And
sorry for those of you who are watching me get bigger and smaller. I was trying to find the button where I could make Hassan be the whole screen and then hopefully his book would have shown. But I am not smart enough to figure that out for some reason. I don't know why.
Right. Yeah, but it has been what I'm excited about The Race is that I actually wrote it based on my own experiences and then experiences of young people I've heard over the years. And it starts with a kid who's, it was a day like the rest, me sitting right there with the lost kids in another special class where we would fit the round pegs in the square holes all day. As the teachers explained, we were made just that way. And that's the start of so many sad stories in our schools and our communities. And explaining, people telling you that this is the best it's going to be for you, so you should be okay with that. But then he finds a note from his mother, right, his hope dealer, saying, hey, I know you're there and people telling you you're there, but I don't think that's where you need to be. But you need to figure out how to get out of there and not accept this. And then he looks up and there's a window in the room where he's never seen the window. And he hears all this excitement outside. So he escapes out the window and down the pole and goes over to the track where everybody's doing this exciting stuff and tries things that he's never tried before and fails, but does amazing for him, his personal best. And then he gets pulled back to the class saying, oh, that's not the life for you. This is much more safe. This is better. And that interesting. That is that there's one line, there are round pegs in your future. These square holes must be filled. It's good work for your hands and your particular skill. And that line in particular comes from a conversation I had with my voc rehab counselor in law school after I successfully navigated college, which took me 7 years and being expelled three times and fighting my way in. I decided to go to law school. And when I got into law school, I finally said, I'm going to go see a voc rehab. I'm going to finally go get a champion because we are about to just tear things up. And I went to see my new counselor. And after going over my records and, my big file of, oh my goodness, she had the most compassionate look on her face. And I imagine so many folk who care about broken children and broken lives. And she looked at me and she says, Hassan, you have failed your whole life. And I'm really afraid that me supporting you in law school is just going to be another failure. And I can't have that on my conscience. Wow. So here's what I've decided to do. She opened her drawer and she pulled out a handful of pamphlets and booklets. She says, I have all these amazing programs where you could learn to do something with your hands, something you could be proud of for the rest of your life. And I think this is a much better, much safer bet for us. Remember to listen to the tone. Us, she kept saying, we aren't going to do well, right? This is a total investment in her not wanting to fail by me failing, not recognizing that I'm used to failing. I got scars over 90% of my body from failing. And the amazing thing is I've gotten up every time. And so often when we're in that position where we're looking at young people who are navigating crisis, we're like, oh, my God, I don't want them to fall again. Instead of going, look how tough they are. If they fall down, they're going to be good. Let's take it up a level. Right. Yep. Not lower the bar so they can trip over. But let's raise it so they got something to go for. And so that frustration at the beginning of my law school career, I just walked out of her office and never went back. I was like, OK, I guess I'm going to have to do this like the rest. I'm going to have to fight through every day of it. And I got expelled 3 times from law school. I never missed a day of class because I just told them I'm not leaving. They're like, maybe you don't understand what the word expelled means. Like, I have lots of experience with that word, my friend. I'm just not leaving. Maybe you didn't read my application very closely. But the idea of the race is that there are those around us and those who are us who don't give up, who and the things that we accomplish are amazing for us, if nobody else, but it's because we refuse to accept that somebody else knows us better than we do and knows what's best for us in our dreams. And I think in our very best work, in your best work, when you are supporting IAP development, is helping people imagine themselves greater and then helping them plan to get there. And whether they get there or not, again, this the definition of hope is not making everyone successful. It's giving everybody the tools and on the path to decide if that's the success that they want. And that's so much about what we are missing in many of our environments right now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Let me take a deep breath again.
No, unfortunately, I may have to have you back. That's not the unfortunate part. The unfortunate part is that we're out of time. But I would love to have you back because, like I said, your story is just so incredible. And this sentence that you have on your website, which I know I've stopped sharing, but I've jumped back over to it, is how do we ensure that every child achieves their greatest potential? And that's exactly it. That's the hashtag no limits right there.
That's
we
right.
are to write, you know, when I'm writing IEPs, I'm trying to write so that the child can achieve their fullest and greatest potential.
That's exactly it.
That's it right there. And, you know, I mean, imagine how much more wonderful our world could be if everybody believed in everyone else's potential.
Potential. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Hassan, thank you so very much for joining me today. And yeah, I mean, if we can work it out that you can come back another time, you're just such a wealth of knowledge and you have so much great insight and so much hope. Make sure people, if you are listening as a podcast, once this gets out that way, or if you've joined us today, thank you, Fran, by the way, she did say hi from Southern Illinois. And anyone else who joined today that didn't comment or is watching this in the replay, make sure you visit HassanDavis.com and check him out. And if you get the opportunity to listen to him in person and you get to meet him, he's such a fun guy. I had the opportunity to go out to dinner after the conference with him and a few other people and get to know him and his son a little bit better. He's as he is today on here, he is in person and even more so, even more fun. So I thank you. I'm glad you had a wonderful holiday season. Hassan, thank you again. Tell your family hello and we will see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you all.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-Y-K-I-N-O.com. LLEYKENOW.